everyone. It is Tuesday, October 22nd. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So you're going to think I'm crazy, Ken. So on this beautiful Tuesday morning or afternoon or midday or whatever it is, my best friend is 99 years old. Okay. Mm-hmm. She was my bridesmaid in 2002 when I married Marty. And I woke up this morning and I went, I'm 66. 33 years ago, I was 33. 33 years into the future, I will be 99. And I'm thinking, I'm like right at that sweet spot. So Mary Lou is exactly 33. I mean, it just feels like 33, 66, 30, you know, 99. I'm right in the center of our lives. And I keep thinking, can you imagine living 33 more years after the age of 66? And I would just touch what she is now. And she plays bridge 3 days a week and drives still and lives alone. Is she? I mean, she and Jimmy Carter. She and Jimmy Carter are indefatigable. Yeah. They're remarkable. And up until a couple of years ago, she used to stand out in front of the Feminist Health Center whenever they had the abortions happening in order to protect the women that were going into the Feminist Health Center. Oh, and they finally had to tell her she had to not do it anymore because they were actually more worried about her than they worried about them. but that is – isn't that remarkable? And I got to share one more
little – That is so great. I hope I'll be doing that when I'm 99.
If I get to 99. She is my role model, and yet what's so interesting is she met me when I was running for governor in 1991. She had not voted in probably 40 years. She was a Republican from New Jersey, very wealthy Republican woman, and yet she had sort of just completely disengaged with politics. And I started noticing her at all my events in Concord, New Hampshire. I would speak at one event, and I'd see this older woman, and then I'd speak at another event. And finally, on the third event, I walked up to the same older woman, and I said, "Are you stalking me?" And she looked at me, and she said, "No, I wanted to make sure you were real and authentic and that you didn't deliver a different message based on what you saw in the audience." And I said, "So how did I do?" She said, "I want to help you and I will vote for you."
Oh, great.
We have been absolute bonded at the hip ever since. Isn't that amazing? And it was because of running for governor that I found her or she found me. It's beautiful. And she's still my closest friend. She was my bridesmaid in 2002. I mean, what else could you say?
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
There's reward to doing good in the world. You go out and you do what you believe in and you stuck your neck out, did what was right, and I was rewarded by finding wonderful people.
Exactly. So I woke up this morning thinking 99, 66. Oh my God. Anyway, all right, darling, what would you like to talk about before we grab Harold Meyerson from The American Prospect?
Well, you know, I've been involved with a lot of immigration issues. I am talking to people on the border, the Southwest border, about going down there again to help out. And it's interesting, things that you don't know if you're not actually looking into it. There's a group called Team Brownsville in Brownsville, Texas, the southernmost part of the United States. And they are amazingly giving. They have a lot of volunteers who work with the immigrants there. Mm-hmm. And this MPP, the Remain in Mexico policy, where we make immigrants wait outside of this country before they can even apply for asylum, which is pretty outrageous. They have been staying fairly close to the border, the immigrants in kind of camps. Mm-hmm. And so these folks go over, they work on this side of the border and they make food and big meals for people and get clothing together.
And
then they bring them down to Matamoros in Mexico to distribute them to folks who are there living in tents who have nothing and feeding people and everything. And now, because Mr. Trump has worked out such a good deal with the Mexicans, the Mexicans are going to move these immigrants away from the border, further distance into the inner city of Matamoros, which is pretty dangerous. So it will be too far for this group of volunteers to really go and incredibly risky with all the gangs and drug lords and everything that's going on there. They can bring it across the border a certain distance to feed people in tents, but they can't schlep it however far. It reminds me of the people that our government prosecuted who were leaving water in the desert for the immigrants that were trying to survive, and prosecuting the nice folks who were giving of themselves, trying to make it easier for people to live.
They call it the Good Samaritan.
Yeah, but that was punishing the Good Samaritan and trying to put those folks in jail for giving water. This, they're clearly punishing the immigrants more than they're punishing the Good Samaritans by moving them so far away from the border that nobody can bring them food.
Well, it's intentional because as long as they're getting food, they'll stick around. What they're trying to do is make sure if they starve, maybe they'll go home.
Right. So people in a number of places that are making the decision, like mothers who bring their children, are making the decision where to die. Am I going to die close to the American border trying to get in and apply for asylum?
Am I going to die
out here outside the border? Or am I going to die at home and take my kids back to wherever I fled from where the violence there was – there were people there trying to kill me and so we can get killed over there.
Now think of what we just did to the Kurds.
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah. I just can't. I'm so – you know what's fascinating though? I think in a way his action with the Kurds is now really giving pause to Republicans where – they don't really care about the election and about the manipulation. In fact, to their from their vantage point, since they've embraced dark money and partisan gerrymandering, they like to manipulate elections. That's really what they want to do. They want to choose their voters. They want to manipulate elections. So if you go to the Ukraine, if you go to Putin, if you go to China, who gives a crap, okay?
Right,
they understand.
Exactly.
They understand that kind of manipulation. Mm-hmm. But what he is doing now with his foreign policy and this grotesque abuse of that policy – I think is unnerving them. And in a way, it's becoming synergistic because it's giving Republicans an opportunity to sort of maybe even consider embracing impeachment, not because of Ukraine, not because of the quid pro quo, but because they cannot, as you pointed out to me the other day, because you make bad foreign policy choices, that's not a rationale for impeachment. But guess what? For Republicans, it probably would be. And so what they're seeing is he's making this horrific, putting us at risk, putting the Middle East at risk, putting the world at risk. And even though, as you said, you can't impeach for that, Republicans now might feel that they're being more pushed into embracing impeachment because of that behavior.
Yes, but I would add one other thing, and that is that I don't think the Republican politicians are doing it for altruistic reasons. They're not doing it because they really care that this is beyond the pale and putting the country and the world at risk. I think that they're doing it because they know that the voters will vote against them and they're worried about them not being able to go out on the hustings next year.
Not yet. Another 10% change in the polls and maybe yet, but not yet. But it's going to be very, very interesting. All right, everyone. We're going to be grabbing Harold Meyerson, who is the, I guess, executive editor at the American Prospect. He's one of the founders of the American Prospect. And as I was saying to Ken this morning, I love the title of the piece that we're going to be using as our kickoff for the conversation today. And I went to the Prospect about 2 days ago, and the title of his piece was, ready, everyone? The Fierce Urgency of Less. I have to tell you, Harold, you're brilliant. You're absolutely brilliant. All right. So before I grab Harold Meyerson, I do want to share one thing with you. There was a story at The Insider this morning, and the story at The Insider was as follows. A 14-year-old boy shot his way into a school before turning the gun on himself. Now his mother is facing 6 felony charges. Here is just one nugget from the story from The Insider. Court documents obtained by Indianapolis station WXIN said York, the mother, withdrew her son from a mental health treatment program after 10 days because it wasn't covered by insurance and she couldn't afford it. I don't know about you, but I think we need to fix our healthcare system. And as someone said, they looked at, you know, the rest of the story and the mother still had guns in her house and she warned the school that her son was coming over. So they had locked down the school and he apparently had attempted to try to kill her boyfriend. I mean, the story is obviously much more complex than what you're hearing in the headline. But I just want to let you know that one of the rationales for her not giving her son the kind of mental health counseling he needed was that she couldn't afford it. And I'm just telling you, so now we can afford his death and we can afford the school shutdown and we can afford the 6 felony counts against the mother. Yep. Let's not fix the healthcare system. Let's massage the current one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Joining us right now on the line is one of our great talkers, Harold Meyerson, who, as I've been waxing poetic about the title of the first piece I want to talk to you about, The Fierce Urgency of Less. Oh, God, that is the most slaying headline I've ever seen. Welcome to the program, Harold. How are you?
Always good to be here, Arnie.
And so it's just, you know, I was thinking the names that were popping into my head as I was reading it, like Amy Klobuchar, you know, and Mayor Pete to some extent. It's yes. The people that said, I'm not going to promise you anything that I can't deliver on. Oh, that's good. Then I guess we're not going anywhere. You know, as if they control the future. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, just ask Supreme Court Justice Merrick Garland on how willing the Republicans in the Senate are to endorse anything moderate, let alone conservative. I mean, you know, after how many times did they attempt to repeal Obamacare?
Yeah.
So has anyone noticed what the actual existing Republican Party is like these days? Have the moderates, has Amy Klobuchar, have Pete Buttigieg noticed that?
Yeah, I know. I think I did send you an article because as I was reading your piece, I was kind of screaming in the background. And in 2017, Max Baucus, who was the senator from Montana, who was responsible for the passage of the Affordable Care Act, who ensured that the insurance companies got what they wanted, no public option, who ensured that the doctors that wanted at least single payer to be considered by the committee, basically had them arrested in 2017, you know, far after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, actually had the chutzpah to say, maybe we should have talked about Medicare for all or single payer. It would have given people a sense of the spectrum. So guess what? The Affordable Care Act would have looked moderate and middle as opposed to the communist plot that the Republicans packaged it as. Oh,
absolutely.
My God.
Yes. Well, now he tells us.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But in 2017, he was also long since retired.
Yeah,
so, you know, anyway.
But why don't people understand? I always said this, Harold, and you will understand. So in 1992, when I ran for governor, not only was I the first girl, but I was someone who decided to sort of challenge everything that the Democrats and the Republicans had assumed would be true, that you couldn't talk about a change to the healthcare system, that you couldn't talk about a change to the tax structure, that you couldn't talk about more sort of progressive policies, that was verboten. I couldn't win a primary, and I clearly could not win a general election. Well, what ended up happening was I did win the primary by a huge margin against the party chairman and the five-term congressman. I may have lost the election, but I lost the election with the most votes any Democrat had ever gotten in history. And when you look at what I swept in behind me, even though I lost, it became one of the most progressive legislators we've ever had. And it was because I created a spectrum. I created this opportunity for some people who were willing to sort of risk thinking the same thing to get swept in. And ever since then, New Hampshire went from being a red state to a purple to blue state. Look what happened by taking that risk. It changed the political landscape.
And, you know, you can say much the same for Bernie Sanders in 2016.
Yes, exactly.
And for both Bernie and Elizabeth Warren today.
Exactly.
They have helped spark a movement. You know, I mean, in a sense, you know, they didn't call into being a new American progressive movement. They just sort of discovered it and let that movement, you know, discover itself.
Yeah.
They revealed it. Because polling for a long time had shown particularly the younger Americans were moving well to the left of where their elders were, that they had fundamental doubts about the economic system, and they had no doubt that it was not working for them. But, you know, you need someone like you in 1992 or Bernie in 2016 or Bernie and Elizabeth today to raise the banner, and once the banner is raised, a lot of folks are going to come running, and we'll change the system eventually.
Well, has anyone sat down with Mayor Pete and asked him what he would do? Because he does talk about urgency, and he talks about the fact that he's young and almost by definition, so he will be changed because of his age. Okay? He kind of uses that as his, this is code. Trust me. If I'm close to your age, you know I understand. But I'm trying to figure out, when he understands the term of urgency, what would he do to respond to that urgency? What does he see as urgent? You know, I want to define it for me.
Yeah, well, he talks about, you know, that one of his refrains in the last debate was, we can't wait.
Right,
and he
exactly.
used this against not just Warren and Sanders, but Beto O'Rourke on gun control. So I presume that means that, you know, we'll campaign hard for whatever has a chance of passing, even with Republicans. But, you know, it's not as if you don't start campaigning a la what Beto O'Rourke is saying on guns,
right,
and what Bernie and Elizabeth are saying on the broader economy. That doesn't preclude eventually cutting a deal that's somewhat less, but then you go back and get more.
But look where you
but
started.
If you start, I mean, this is part of one of the fallacies, I think, of the Obama presidency, was that, you know, you begin by negotiating with yourself,
yes,
and scaling back what you're,
yes,
asking the,
yes,
House and the Senate to do. So that you do sort of half the work of the conservatives for them before the bill even gets to them.
Well, right, you're afraid of offending them, and they don't care. I mean, it's not like they want to find an answer or a solution. So by negotiating with yourself, you've not only sort of drained all the vitality out of what you're trying to do, you actually haven't accomplished what you had the potential to accomplish. Remember, he had a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. He could have gone much farther, but he was trying to placate Republicans for whatever reason. And guess what? Just by winning, he was, by their sense, going to fail because they want – that was their whole raison d'etre. We want him to be a one-term president, so whatever,
yeah,
he offers,
Mitch,
we're going to reject.
That,
yes.
That's what Mitch McConnell literally,
exactly,
said.
Exactly.
So if that isn't a clear signal, yeah, that you're not going to get a good reception for anything you propose, I don't know what is.
Well, and what – but I guess maybe that's what I respect about Republicans is that they go for broke. You know, we go for less and they go for broke. I mean, some of the things that they suggest, you would think, how the hell do you have the chutzpah to do it? But that isn't even the issue. It's kind of how Mitch McConnell is sort of operating in the United States Senate. Nobody would be operating that way. No Democrat would do it. But Mitch McConnell thinks it's his license to do it. And now we have what's going on with Donald Trump. But I think it's important for us to understand that you have to reach for more. You do reach for the stars. Someday we'll land a man on the moon. Someday we'll do this. I mean, you don't just say we'll build a rocket, you know, to go,
right,
where? I mean, oh, my God. And that's what you have to love about JFK. So I'm glad that you sort of reminded us how important the spectrum is, because it not only helps us find true middle, but it also reminds us where we ultimately want to go, and it creates that incentive to get there. And I think
and you
that's
don't,
important.
You don't even get to the middle unless you advocate for something more.
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
exactly,
if you come in advocating for a middling position, you're going to get something less than middling. So, you know, I mean, you need to build public support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, someone else who was taking this line in an op-ed in, I forget, I read too many papers, mm-hmm, I think it was the New York Times, it might have been the Washington Post, by former New York Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, saying, you know, you can't just go around saying, well, I'll have the bully pulpit. You have to spell out what deal you'll settle for. I mean, you know, so this is kind of denigrating the presidencies of both Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
I mean, you need to build public support for ambitious programs, and then if you settle for a little less, okay,
right,
you settle for a little less, but you're not going to get even a little less unless you use a bully pulpit, unless you try to mobilize millions of Americans for something that will fundamentally affect their lives.
Right. And I think the idea that, you know, I always listen to Amy about talking about, you know, I won't promise you anything I can't deliver on, which makes me think she won't promise anything. But more importantly, so someone called me this morning to talk about Amy Klobuchar, and they said, you know, she's been able to work across the aisle more effectively than any other U.S. senator. So here was my question, Harold. Really? And what did those across-the-aisle bills produce of value?
Yeah, I get a stream of emails from her you know, bills that she has co-sponsored with a Republican that have been enacted. But they're, mm-hmm, sort of all on the level of National Asparagus Week.
Yes, exactly,
yeah,
right.
I mean,
thank you.
You know, I mean, they're,
thank you.
It's barely worth putting out a press release on. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I mean,
yeah,
I look at it and say, oh, God, another one of these.
Well, no,
so,
it's like I've embraced vanilla. And I had a Republican say, yeah, I like vanilla too. Oh, my God. Well, there you go. It's a bipartisan vanilla. It doesn't change people's lives. It doesn't fix what has to be historically fixed. And that's part of the problem. And that doesn't excite. And one of the things I think about the problem with that, you know, the fierce urgency of less, is how does that bring out the base that we need? How does that bring out the? It doesn't. It's not an invitation to minorities. It's not an invitation to Hispanics. It's not an invitation to young people. It's an invitation to say knit one, pearl two.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of what the Democrats are counting upon is opposition to Trump, but that in itself is not sufficient.
No.
And if you'll recall, the closing weeks of Hillary Clinton's late lamented 2016 campaign was all about opposition to Trump and not really any policy stuff, and we know where that got us. So, you know, the Democrats have to really offer something, and they have to they have to really offer something, because what's out there isn't working for so many millions of potential Democratic voters.
Right.
And, you know, what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are proposing, and some of the other candidates too on occasion, really does would affect the lives of those voters in a very positive way. But, you know, you got to convey that message if you're going to get those voters to the polls.
Can I just suggest that I agree with you, especially on an analysis of the negotiations? But I think that a key factor is who you're negotiating with. If you're negotiating with reasonable people, like used to be in the Republican Party, then you can have a negotiation that actually works because both sides are going to compromise. But if you start with a group on one side that digs in its heels and says, like McConnell did,
right,
anything that the Democrats want to pass, I'm not going to approve, then what's the point of saying that you're bipartisan and you're negotiating with them? And from a PR point of view, I wonder if you agree, Harold, I think that the progressive candidates need to raise that issue. When Amy Klobuchar and Pete and everybody talk about how bipartisan they are and they negotiate these deals with the Republicans. And
with whom?
Yeah. Why is it a good thing to say you're going to negotiate with the Republicans in Congress when their leaders are saying we're not going to approve anything that you think is good? I mean, that kind of negotiation
right.
is only going to get you National Asparagus
Week.
See,
I mean, Joe Biden, in sort of advancing that line, is remembering back. He's had a long career, remembering back to the Senate he joined in 1972, which even contained at that point people like Jacob Javits, who were more or less liberal Republicans, you know, a group that is currently as extinct as the dodo bird. You know, and so Biden has at least the excuse of a dim memory. No such excuse can be called upon by either Buttigieg or Klobuchar. I mean, they're presumably sentient beings in the year 2019, and they have to know that the Republicans reject anything a Democrat proposes. Even of the most moderate, inoffensive, Klobuchar's great achievement, I suppose,
right,
is finding causes so inoffensive that she can get Republican co-sponsorship.
And that's been my point.
Yeah.
And when she says that all the time, I want to turn to her and say, okay, Amy, so let's talk about the bills you've passed, and let's talk about their significance in people's lives. How has it changed people? And that I think is important. So this morning I was just telling Ken that on my Facebook page, I woke up and I realized I wrote this. I wrote, the GOP wrote its own obit when they perfected partisan gerrymandering and encouraged dark money, soul-destroying, spine-crushing. And the reason I wrote that, Harold, is that I did know Republicans that I could negotiate with. I did know Republicans that actually believed that there was a value to policy. They did not see me as the enemy. They knew I came to the table with a different perspective, but I was not someone to be destroyed. I was someone to have a conversation with. That has changed. And that is so unfortunate. But given the idea of bipartisanship, it cannot exist with people that basically want to see government destroyed and see you as the enemy, not just as a partisan.
And it's not just their allegiance to the kind of big money campaign finance and the gerrymandering. It's also that the Republican base watches Fox News and gets an alternative set of facts or counterfacts,
yes,
as
right,
it were.
Right.
I mean, if Fox News had been around in 1974, I'm not at all confident that Richard Nixon would have been driven from office.
Yes.
Once the final tapes came out, all the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee said, yes, we will vote for impeachment, so that de facto then at that point the vote would have been 38 to nothing. Well, right, you know, that was when you didn't have Fox News saying, actually, the attacks on Nixon are all fabricated, this is fake news, etc. Now you have it that this is all fabricated stuff and the attacks on Trump are fake news, and it creates a Republican base that is just in some ways, not in all ways, but in some ways, very different from what there was in the years of Watergate.
So, last question, Harold, as we're thinking about this, how do we actually survive with the social media and the partisan gerrymandering and, you know, the unlimited dark money and no term limits? And how does democracy survive?
Well, it's a daily struggle. And, you know, we mainly survive by mobilizing our people and reaching them with messages that they that resonate with them, as I think progressive candidates are doing.
Yeah.
And that's how you win elections.
So increasing the numbers
of people.
Partly
how the Democrats retook the House in 2018.
Right. They just, again, you have to find new voters and bring them into the fold. On that note, Harold Meyerson, thank you so much. I love the I love your piece. Everyone go to theamericanprospect.org. Ciao. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Arnie.
You're
Take
welcome.
Care.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone, a little labor history
I'm
is
Rick
next.
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that the bank robber known as Pretty Boy Floyd was gunned down by federal agents in Ohio. He was born Charles Arthur Floyd in 1904 in Georgia. His family moved to Oklahoma when he was a boy. Like many Oklahomans during this era, he fell on hard economic times. Floyd turned to crime. He did a four-year stretch in a Missouri prison for payroll robbery. When he got out, he tried to get a job in the Oklahoma oil fields. Unable to find work, Floyd took up bank robbing. He robbed banks in Kentucky, Ohio, and Missouri. He got caught and convicted in Ohio, but escaped on his train trip to prison. He made his way back to Oklahoma. There he became a folk hero. Locals called him the Robin Hood of the Cookson Hills. Legend had it that Floyd destroyed mortgage papers when he robbed banks, winning him friends among farmers reeling from the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. Floyd became a national fugitive when he was accused of killing federal agents in Kansas City. He denied he was ever involved in the killings. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the U.S. Bureau of Investigation, named Floyd public enemy number one. Finally, the law caught up with Floyd in an Ohio cornfield. His body was returned to Oklahoma, where as many as 40,000 came to his funeral. Woody Guthrie remembered Floyd in song.
But a many a starving farmer, the same old story told. How the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little home.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left a $1,000 bill.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. There are hundreds of millions of acres of public land in the U.S., but not everyone has had the chance to hike in a national forest or picnic in a state park.
There's a gap, definitely, between communities of color, Latino communities, and access to these green spaces and these experiences.
That's Felipe Benitez of Corazon Latino, a nonprofit that helps urban residents spend more time in nature. The group organizes outdoor events at parks and forests, and they encourage families to visit on their own, by providing directions and activity ideas in Spanish.
The cousins, the abuelitos, the little kids, everybody will come. So you want to make sure that you are providing information on what to do, information about safety, information about conservation.
He says the group's goal is to encourage recreation and stewardship. When people feel connected to parks and forests, they want to preserve them. That's important for the climate because trees store a lot of carbon.
We don't need to train Latino communities on how to be good environmental stewards. Culturally, it's part of our DNA. We just need to sometimes remind ourselves that it is important we are stewards of the land. We're protecting our Madre Tierra.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Yes, girls.
right, everyone. We are attempting to grab our guest, which explains why the music Hot, Hot, Hot by Buster. Who? Poindexter.
Buster Poindexter.
Oh, am I supposed to know who Buster Poindexter is? I guess.
Oh, Buster. He was a big deal about 20 years ago or maybe 30 years ago. I'm dating myself. But the weather's getting hot, hot, hot.
Especially in California.
Especially in California. Because, and there's fire, fire, fire.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. So we are trying to reach out to a professor who directs, listen to his position. His name is Girish Shramali. He is the director of the India Office of Climate Policy Initiative. Now you're going, wait a minute, Arnie, we're talking about California fires. Hold your horses. Mm. He is also a research fellow at Stanford University's Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance, a joint center of the Stanford Law and Business School. And the title of his piece, which is what intrigued me, was "In Fire-Prone California, Many Residents Can't Afford Wildfire Insurance." And there was another article that was actually written right about the same time as this article. And it was written also about the fact that people are saying, look, we can't afford to do this. So maybe what we need to do is just ban people from living in those areas. They can't afford the insurance. We're running risks. We're going out to try to save them, yada, yada, yada. And the guy that wrote the sort of companion article to this wrote an article that said, you know, rather than banning people from living in those locations, maybe what you need to do is just basically say you need to actually pay for it. And he said, if you actually have people incur the costs and the raising costs on this area, then you will find out that people may make a decision, not because you said you can't live in this region, but you're saying this is the impediment to living here. You have to purchase this insurance. You have to build these kind of materials on your house. You have to own so much property. You have to have so many, you know, water systems around your house. All those things where people are suddenly doing the cost-benefit analysis, and the idea of living in an area like this might dissuade them from doing it. And he said, as a behavioral psychologist, this tends to work better than actually banning. And, you know, it's really funny. As I was reading this, you know what came into my head? This is the behavioral guy. And the idea of having people incur costs so that they understand what the real cost of living there is that I used to be a proponent back in the 1980s of a bottle bill. And the bottle bill, you remember, and, you know, not too many states have passed it recently, but the bottle bill puts a cost on a can or a bottle of soda. And therefore, because you put a cost on a can or a bottle of soda, people don't throw it away. So by monetizing it, you've actually taught people a changed behavior. And they realize they don't want to throw away a nickel. They don't want to throw away a dime. And so as a result, unbeknownst to them, they started to recycle. So money was an effective tool of teaching them the sort of recycling ethic. So I'm thinking about the idea that we have to give people a sense of what the real cost is. And so that's one of the reasons why, one, I was pointing to this new article at The Conversation, but I'm also going to bring in our guest who wrote the original article, which was entitled "In Fire-Prone California, Many Residents Can't Afford Wildfire Insurance." Girish Ramali is from Stanford University. If I pronounce your name wrong, please correct the record. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the call.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So tell me exactly, what is it that you do for a living? I was trying to figure out exactly how to sort of define your job skill and your definition so that we can then understand how you are doing the analysis of how California should move forward, especially in light of the fact that, you know, people buy a home, they want to go out and buy insurance, but in places where insurance companies realize, you know what, you live in a risky area, I can't afford to insure you anymore, the idea of buying fire insurance is becoming more and more prohibitive.
Yeah, so I'm a researcher, and my research focuses on the intersection of finance and policy. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I look at the element of risk and how risk influences either financing or investments into any particular outcome. I've done a lot of work on renewable energy and energy in general, and in recent times, I've gotten interested in this issue of fire.
Right.
And fire insurance and how, you know, fire insurance is getting priced today in California. And therefore, I wrote this article.
So as you point out that California, you write in your article, California faces wildfire risks on an epic scale. We realize this. I'm just going to share one of the nuggets of numbers that you gave because I think numbers are powerful tools. In 2017, wildfires caused at least $18 billion in damages, including $13.2 billion in insured losses, $3 billion in other economic losses, and $1.8 billion in fire suppression costs. In 2018, a total of 8,527 fires burned, 1,893,913 acres, the largest area recorded in a fire season. The disastrous Camp Fire, just this one fire, caused $16.5 billion in damages, including $12.5 billion in uninsured losses. Let me remind you that you gave us the total for 2017, which was $18 billion, and then you gave us one fire at $16.5 billion in 2018. So people will begin to comprehend the incredible, incredible cost of these fires. So here's the question that I want to begin with. You are looking at risk and doing this analysis. Part of the problem for the insurance industry, and maybe even part of the problem for people who originally bought these houses, not 2 years ago, but maybe 5 years ago or 15 years ago, is that as a result of climate change, we are seeing a change in weather patterns. And the kind of extreme weather that we're facing today is much different than what we may have faced in the past. So how do we start adjusting the models since we are galloping into a really, I think, frightening climate crisis situation? How do you even look at this and try to figure out how to assess risk?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just to add to what you had just said, you know, in some sense, the average losses used to be around $2 billion a year. In the last 2 years, we have seen losses gone up to $20 billion a year.
Oh, God.
And that has resulted in, insurance going up, in some cases up to 300 to 500%, which is 3 to 5 times.
Right.
Many people cannot get insurance. About 350,000 people cannot get insurance. And as you correctly pointed out, one of the reasons for this increased severity or increased damages because of fire is climate change, and that's one area that I do research on.
Right.
Climate change is causing temperatures to rise, causing more dry conditions. And in some sense, it's also resulting in, higher variability in rainfall. Climate change is definitely a, variable and a driver of what's happening. But I also wanted to point out that it's not the only variable. And that has to be clear as well. What's happening in California and other states is that, forest management has to step up. There has been a lot of policies in recent times where we have tried to protect our forests, and that has resulted in growth that's now unmanageable, and when it catches fire, it's hard to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And the third factor that's come up is land use practices and
right.
urban development.
Exactly.
And as people are getting pushed out of population centers and financial centers, they're building in places that are pretty high risk.
Yes.
From a fire perspective. So I just wanted to give that perspective before we go into what are the implications for insurance itself.
Okay, so let me just say something. You raise an interesting point. So I'm between a rock and a hard place with one of your comments, and that's this. You talked about the fact that, you know, the forest management and that we wanted to protect our forests, and to some extent that has actually sort of created a raison d'etre for more fires because we wanted to protect our forests. But my understanding is we need trees to address the carbon situation on the planet, and people are being encouraged to actually protect their forests, plant more trees. So how do we address the risk of fire and at the same time recognize that that means if I'm supposed to thin my forest or cut down trees, I'm actually working in a counter purpose to what I'm being told to do, which is plant trees and protect forests? I mean, I hate to break it to you, but how do I make that choice? I feel like I'm making Sophie's choice. Cut down a tree and lose that carbon soaking ability, or, keep that tree and then die from a fire. there. I mean, you tell me which one I should answer.
So it's about growing more trees, but also managing our forests well. So if you see, that is happening. And so the idea is that you are growing more trees, but you're also managing your fires. So you're aware of the fact that there could be more fires. So you create forest management practices. You create areas, levees, for example, or just blockades, etc. So that, if fire happens, it's contained.
Right.
And you would see that practice is very prevalent in one of our major national parks here in California, the Yosemite National Park. There are controlled fires now just to make sure that if a fire really happens, it doesn't get out of control. But that doesn't mean that we are not growing trees. It's the idea of kind of forest fire management. And just to give you a sense, I mean, the California Fire Department is aware of this.
Right.
And they are, significantly under-resourced. I mean, I heard numbers on the order of they need about 500,000 people to manage the forest, and they have pretty much one-tenth. And this is after their budget has gone up like four times in the last year or two. So it's well known, yeah.
All right. So now let's talk about what you say. You write the challenges for insurers. What do these trends mean for the insurance industry? Because as you pointed out, we're looking at significant increased risk. We're looking at patterns of the past that don't work into the future. We look at people building in places they shouldn't have built in. So you've got all these things. And so you've got the state sometimes stepping in saying, okay, we'll be the insurer of last resort. But, the insurance industry is in the business of writing policies. So how do you write a policy knowing that you're going to hemorrhage and lose billions and billions of dollars? That's not a forecast for a delightfully profitable future.
Yeah, so just to kind of get a little bit into the insurance industry and my understanding of it, a lot of the insurance pricing happens based on assessment of fire risk and risk of fire damages.
Right.
And it's primarily been done based on historical data. And it has been the assumption that, history is kind of going to predict the future. Mm-hmm. In mathematical terms, these are called stationary models or models that don't change over time.
Right.
What's really happening is that because the climate is changing, we are starting to see conditions that did not happen in at least the recent past or the past in which we were doing this models.
Right.
So what is required is, what is happening is that perhaps there's a higher assignment of risk on fires and therefore, non-continuation of these premium or these policies. So where it needs to go is better modeling and better modeling that combines, and that's where the state of the art is, better modeling that combines the predictions based on historical data, but also uses what we call the futuristic simulations of the climate. The term uses ex-ante simulation, which is just simulate the climate based on what your understanding of how the climate is going to change and combine these two methods to come up with more accurate models that will be used to then price the premium. Okay. So this is just from the modeling perspective, and I can get into some of the policy issues in a bit.
I want to talk a little bit about the policy issue. So I'm a Medicare for All person. I'm going to go into health insurance, but I'm going to explain to you why I'm going there before I back into this. And my understanding is that the reason the concept of insurance is you want old people and young people and healthy people and sick people and all this stuff, and therefore you spread the risk and you're willing to then make it more cost effective for everyone because you make sure that people who won't cost the system a lot of money are in the system to balance off the people that cost the system a lot of money. Now, with health insurance, that seems like a reasonable idea. So now let's talk about the kind of insurance that we're talking about with house insurance or home insurance, and we're talking about fire risk. I'm not sure I want my insurance bill to go up because someone decided to buy a house in the middle of a fire risk zone because they like the environment, but they know that the potential for their house to burn has now gone up exponentially. So why should I, living in a modest home in a relatively safe area, basically say, I have no problem with my insurance going up because you've embraced this risky place to live and you want me to help pay for this fire risk? And I don't want to be selfish, but at the same time, it doesn't seem to be an answer when you could live as comfortably as you want in a place that's less risky, and we could address the problems of fire. But this is something like that is just so devastating that I'm not sure I want to write a bigger check for that kind of devastation.
Yes, and before we get to this issue of socializing costs,
right.
I wanted to address the issue that you raised, and I think that's a big issue, which is to say that the first step needs to be what we call risk-based pricing, and that risk-based pricing is very important, and that essentially means that insurance mm-hmm. that you pay is based on the risk that you've taken, in this case, you know, building houses in
right.
risky areas.
Right.
And this I think unless that happens, the issue that you talked about will become a bigger issue. But I want to come to the issue that you talked about as well.
Right.
Now that we have done risk-based pricing, I'm also looking at the perspective of society, which means not only the people living in the society, but insurers and policymakers.
Right.
Insurers will provide, let's say, insurance based on risk, and higher risk people will get, you know, higher price premium.
Right.
But in this case, we are likely to see, especially if the fire risk is going up, it could happen that only people with high fire risk buy the, you know, premium or insurance, and low risk people do not buy if you're given them a choice.
Right.
And that kind of escalates this issue, what we call adverse selection, where the insurance premium keep on going out of proportion and only very high-risk people buy it.
Right.
And at the end of the day, the state is on the hook for taking care of them.
Exactly.
So that's where the argument for socialization of the cost comes in. I mean, how do you want to do it, whether the state eventually takes care of it through taxpayer money or state mandates a market where everybody's buying insurance and socializes that in the market. The other issues around this is that if there's not enough big enough market, because there's an implicit assumption here that because fire risk is becoming a big enough risk, we kind of end up separating it from the household insurance and treat it as
right.
flood insurance because
right.
it's become big. Mm-hmm. And then you try to price it, and then socialization is not the first step, but the second step, which is going to happen anyways. It depends on how do you spread the cost, whether through taxes or through insurance premium. And the final thing is, you know, as we had talked about this issue that happens, and perhaps I'm bringing in too many things here, but at the end of the day, there has to be an insurer of last resort, in which case, in California's case, it's called FAIR.
Yeah.
And FAIR has to learn from what has happened in the National Flood Insurance Program,
this
where the risk-based pricing was not done, and that resulted in many issues.
Well, yeah. let's remember, we've been covering the whole issue of flood insurance, so you can just sort of tell I have this, like, insurance passion. And one of the problems is that the flood insurance policy has been influenced by politics. So instead of it being able to sort of address in a more rational and reasonable way what it should have done, you see people politically putting their finger on the government program, and as a result, it has been less and less effective. It hasn't been well funded, and places that have been able to receive flood insurance should never have been able to receive it. So there is the political outcomes as well, and that's my biggest fear, is that as soon as we talk about socializing the cost, I want to say it would be wonderful wonderful if it was happening in, you know, on a safe playing field. But more often than not, politics ends up figuring out how we socialize those costs, and that may not benefit folks. And that's what's so scary here. One of the things we're finding out, for example, with floods in like the Houston area, is that people have been flooded and flooded and flooded. And FEMA used to be able to say, okay, we'll buy your house because we don't want to repair it anymore. Well, guess what? They don't have enough money now to buy the house. So these people are sort of stuck, no insurance, living in a moldy home. FEMA originally was used to be able to say, we'll buy you out, but they don't have the capacity to do it. So in a lot of ways, we can't even figure out how to address this because it's so damn complicated.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, God.
And there is also this issue that, you know, if you do want insurance to exist, even though the insurance companies have to figure out the prices, they need to have a demand for that product. Otherwise, they can't price it.
Right, exactly. You know,
so that also comes in, because do you want fire insurance to be available? But I think the bottom line is, I think, as I had said, the first factor and the first condition has to be risk-based pricing. I think the socialization comes later.
Right.
And then there's the remaining issue of what about the houses that are already built in these places?
Right.
And how do you deal with that? And especially, you could take a stance that let the rich take care of themselves, but that many poor people have built in these areas, and you need to ensure that those people are taken care of as well. So that is an equity issue.
So go on.
I don't really understand why, if you have the premiums high enough to cover the actual costs of the risk, let the rich people pay however high the premium has to be in order to have the insurance company be able to spread the risk and cover the costs of the fires, then why does society and all the taxpayers ever have to step in? Except for what you just mentioned at the very end. I thought of this question before you said that, but unless there are people who are poor who have existing houses out there, but basically the rich keep rebuilding their houses out there in California and having them get continually, repeatedly destroyed by fires, they can make other choices. Or they can pay higher premiums. And why does, as Arnie said before, why do any of us who haven't made those choices have to socialize the cost, pay the cost through our taxes?
Yeah, and that has to do with going into what I had just started to talk about a little bit. So obviously we need to do risk-based pricing. But as I had said, as the prices go up, and this is something that we have seen, a similar thing we have seen for example, with rate payers with PG&E or utilities. And the issue is this, right? If the costs are escalating, more and more people drop out, and the prices for the remaining people keep on going up. So the idea is that obviously that's a good market signal, but that could, you know, adversely penalize people who are stuck in the market and who are poor. So again, the socialization has to be carefully done, and B, there has to be an element of, even if there's risk-based pricing, you are helping out the poor who ended up building in these areas before the problem became known. So it's
exactly,
like more of an issue
before the problem became known.
Condition.
Well, again, the title of the piece is "In Fire-Prone California, Many Residents Can't Afford Wildfire Insurance." And I know we keep talking about the interesting refugee problem that we're facing on the southern border because of what's happening in places like Latin America. And I keep wanting to remind everyone, be prepared for the next refugee crisis. It's called the climate refugee. And the climate refugee won't be coming from some other country. It'll be coming from some other part of the United States. And as we're talking about this whole idea of risk and fire insurance and what do we do and how do we move people, please understand that if the rich can rebuild but the poor cannot, where do they go? Where do they go? This is such an important story, Girish, because I think people just don't get it. We are beginning to understand that the refugee problem is ours. There will be climate refugees. And we have to understand if we don't address it now, we're going to see it exacerbated later. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Girish Ramali is a scholar at Stanford University. He advises companies on how to deal with weather and risk. Wow, unbelievable. And how do we end the show?
We end on what could be a high note. Here comes the sun, which always makes me feel good. But also, I guess the sun is heating up the world. So
and it makes those trees grow. Remember, we need those trees, even if we're going to be burning them down. All right, everyone, here we go. The Beatles and Here Comes the Sun.
Here comes the sun, and I say it's all right.